From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The London brothers of Chicago's hard West Side were named Malcolm and Martin, as in X and Luther King Jr. Malcolm's grown up to be a poet, not because he liked pretty words, but because he needed some way to explain, resist, change what he saw around him, and words were what he had. He's with us this hour, On Point, young Chicago poet Malcolm London. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How strong are words? Strong enough to explain, to change hard Chicago? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last May, poet Malcolm London was invited to TED Talks Education in New York to perform his poem, High School Training Ground, about his experience living on Chicago's West Side and traveling north to attend high school. Here's an excerpt from that performance, Malcolm London.
This is a training ground. My high school is Chicago, diverse and segregated on purpose. Social lines are barbed wire. Labels like regulars and honors resonate. I am an honors, but go home with regular students who are soldiers in territory that owns them. This is a training ground to sort out the regulars from the honors, a reoccurring cycle built to recycle the trash of this system. Trained at a young age to capitalize letters, taught now that capitalism raises you, but you have to step on someone else to get there. This is a training ground where one group is taught to lead and the other is made to follow. No wonder so many of my people spit bars, because the truth is hard to swallow. The need for degrees has left so many people frozen. Homework is stressful, but when you go home every day and your home is work, you don't want to pick up any assignments. Reading textbooks is stressful, but reading does not matter when you feel your story is already written, either dead or getting booked. Taking tests is stressful, but bubbling in a Scantron does not stop bullets from bursting. I hear education systems are failing, but I believe they're succeeding at what they're built to do, to train you, to keep you on track, to track down an American dream that has failed so many of us all.
Joining me now from Chicago is Malcolm London. He's 20. Poet, playwright, educator, activist. He grew up in the tough Austin neighborhood in years when Chicago has been struggling with a devastating murder rate. Commuted to school in the well-heeled Lincoln Park District. Found a voice in slam poetry competitions that has lifted him to prominence. He works with the group Young Chicago Authors. Malcolm London, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Who knew back when you started scribbling that your words would push you up some kind of ladder? Here we are, Malcolm.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I definitely didn't know. I don't think my mom knew either, but It's a cool place to be.
What do you mean in that poem when you say reading doesn't matter when you feel your story is already written? What do you mean when you say social lines are barbed wire?
Well, living in a city like Chicago, that is one of the most segregated cities in our country, I say that to mean, you know, the way the city of Chicago is set up, you know, is not, it is on purpose, right? And some people do not have access or are not given access to certain resources. And so when you don't have those access to resources, such as the people and the people I love, you know, from the neighborhood where I'm from, who didn't have those things, you know, it's really hard to sort of follow this trajectory of, you know, going to school, getting good grades, and flying colors on a test score, you know, to succeed, right? It's very difficult to do that when you have so many other things going on, right? It's hard to read when you feel like your story is already written in so many ways where we're told, especially for me, told that I will end up somewhere else. And so it's hard to sort of follow what
the path, you know, this, laid out,
yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
Malcolm, you have this kind of natural clarity about you. When you say Chicago is set up on purpose for what? With what consequence?
Well, you know, I'd like to be very, very hopeful and very, very imaginative that if, you know, if you say, you know, things are bad, that people will want to change them. But however, as I grow and as I learn, unfortunately, there are people who profit from the devastation that exists in my neighborhood, whether it be the prison industry, whether it be folks who make money off of education and constantly privatizing that. It seems, you know, that there's profit being made and that people are benefiting from, you know, the things that hurt people where I come from. And so while I constantly have to be tattooed to hope, it is, you know, that scary thing is a real thing in which I'm constantly finding out the more I figure out why Chicago looks the way it does.
Tell us about your story. You moved across that map as a high school student. You were in Austin, far west Chicago, pretty darn tough. I'm looking at Chicago Magazine here, a headline, you know, asking if Austin is the deadliest neighborhood in Chicago. You would move from there to a high school in Lincoln Park, very well heeled, north, sort of on the shore there. What was that like? Put us in your shoes. What did you see moving between those communities? What did you experience?
Well, I always say, you know, my bus ride, I took the 66 Chicago Avenue bus. I would get up most days if I could get up on time. You know, I would get up and take the bus, and you would immediately see from that bus ride is where I first learned the differences in the city. You would see after you pass a certain viaduct, the color of the people on that bus would change. The grass would get greener and the homicide rate would vanish. And so that's what I saw. And then I would go to school with my friends, whom I also loved, in my double honors classroom. And they would talk about, you know, sort of their Michigan trips and their
like
Michigan summer home.
Summer house, yeah.
Right, you know, and they would talk about their trips to Italy and Spain and all these really wonderful things that were great, but I also did not see where I came from. And so I would go back home from those stories, but then have to worry not only about, you know, sort of the street corner in which I got off the bus and the folks who were standing there for you know, their own reasons, but, you know, the fear that I had as a teenage boy in that instance, but also be afraid of sort of the people who were supposed to protect and serve me. And so, you know, it was difficult to be in that space. And as a young person, you become frustrated and all kinds of things. And I wasn't able to really articulate that difference until I found sort of spoken word and poetry.
Was the fact that you were there in this, you know, fancy neighborhood, fancy high school, relative to Austin anyway, was that a sign that, hey, there's opportunity in America? Malcolm London was on the ladder.
Yeah, I wasn't concerned with the opportunity to be told that, hey, you're really, you know, I was always told you're really, really smart, Malcolm, but you're, you know, you're a lazy student. So you just need to work hard and you can leave the west side of Chicago. You can leave that desert. And I wasn't concerned with that. I was like, why can't I go to school, learn what I need to learn to make the place where I came from better? And I think the way our education system works is it tells you, you know, to do very well so you can make more money and to continue to build an American dream that is not a reality for most folks. And so, you know, that opportunity didn't, you know, I still reject the idea that sort of you know, I am an exception, right? I think there's a me in every single detention center in this country. There's a me in every facility in Illinois, juvenile mm-hmm. facility in Illinois. There's a me, unfortunately, in a graveyard right now. So I don't, I like to not believe, you know, this opportunity is one that should be available for everybody, and it's not.
Your parents named you and your brother Malcolm and Martin, as yeah, in yeah. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Wow. What do you think they were signaling there? Opportunity boys or struggle boys or what?
Well, I think a little bit of both, right? My father absolutely loves Malcolm and Martin, and I can remember being like 6 years old and in the back of his Lincoln Town Car, he would play these speeches and these speeches on cassette of these folks. And I think those two people are folks, particularly, you know, folks who we idolize those folks, but I definitely think my parents saw, or at least hoped, like all parents do, that I would become important person, I guess. Big shoes to fill, especially with those two names. But we'll see.
Did they roll your eyes when you said, Mom, Dad, maybe I'll be a poet? Or did they say, go get it?
Well, that's an interesting story because I graduated high school with a 1.9. And oh. So my mom was, you know, really worried as to what I would be. So, you know.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with young Chicago poet Malcolm London about mean streets and meaning in Chicago and wherever the young and poor are disenfranchised, pushed aside, Malcolm London tells us. What's the environment he's been riding into? Here's a little taste of it, at least the way NBC Nightly News sees it. This was just last September, Brian Williams reporting on a night of shootings in Chicago.
There has been another mass shooting, this time in Chicago. 20 people in all were wounded in multiple shootings, and one Chicago police official is quoted as saying, "It's a miracle no one died in a night of rampant and brazen violence." And Chicago's been in the spotlight for this very reason. After 500 homicides last year, more than any other city in America.
Including in Malcolm London's neighborhood of Austin, on the far west side of Chicago. Malcolm, read for us. We'll come to what's going on, but we want to hear the way your poetry is maybe transmuting some of this. You've got a poem called Never Too Late, puts you next to your grandfather, gives us a little outlook here. Would you read?
Yeah, yeah. And I want a precursor to that before I read this.
Sure.
Especially after hearing that clip. So here's the real deal, right? In Chicago, violence has been a thing in Chicago since the late 90s. And, it has gone down since then. And particularly, I believe that when we continuously use this rhetoric of, you know, making Chicago a very dangerous city, when you say, oh, my God, those people who live in Inglewood and Austin are scary, you make people not want to love them the same ways that we do or should everybody else. And so this poem I'm going to read is one thing that I try to instill a value in whomever and whatever young person I come across, is that it's never too late to love, and it's never too late to be whom they want to be, and that their stories are invaluable and foundationally, regardless of whom says that they're not.
Yes, please.
And I'll begin the poem. There is one thing the richest man could never purchase. Yesterday. It feels like yesterday I sat Indian style around my grandfather's armchair, suspended above my head like a skyline. His belly beneath denim overalls, reeking of Old Spice and drinking Mississippi cotton gin, he would say, before nodding off to the Wheel of Fortune and waking up when someone turned the station, "If you are early, you are on time. If you are on time, you are late. But it is never too late for your time." The richest man could never purchase yesterday. Yesterday, my grandma says she sees everything on the block. She complained about friends my cousin brings into the house off the street late at night to use her bathroom. She fuss always, but always let folk use her bathroom. The richest man could never purchase yesterday, but could purchase a new bathroom. Every morning, my granddad, a construction worker with massive forearms, building up a city, tearing down his pension, unfurls his bones at 6 a.m. to read the Bible in his pickup truck. I never seen him go to church, but make a chapel out of the garage, and he was never fully awake until my grandma handed him his thermos of coffee. The richest man could never purchase yesterday, but could purchase a lot of coffee. I am a poor man living in the same neighborhood my grandparents could never afford to leave. Every morning I read, 18 shot in a weekend, 300 dead in a summer, 50 schools shut down, public funding cut. Trying to turn poems into eulogies I find in the newspaper. Every day I teach students. Their words will footprint into new front page stories. The richest man could never purchase yesterday, but could purchase a news station. My grandma is a woman carrying a house on her back. Shelter more people who walk in without wiping their feet on the mat. My grandfather of a clock ran out of time before he was ever late. My grandma's favorite pastime is dreaming of my grandpa's past. Every day I sit, pointing to the granddaddy armchair lining in the sky, telling my students, this city is yours. This is your house with all its late night back alley bathroom visits. Under all this construction, you are builders. Hold your dreams like a lover's hand. Hand the next person you see a thermos of coffee. Wake them up. Wake them up. No headline defines you. No amount of money can take away your yesterday. So pick up truck where you left off and keep going. No hands control your time except yours. It is never too late to wake up for your will of fortune. No matter who controls the station, wake up, wake up. It is never too late to love like my grandma taught me. It's never too late to love yourself enough to purchase a new beginning.
I love that, Malcolm, and I love the love in it. It's beautiful. And you're saying, don't lose sight of it. Don't be told you can't grab onto it. You're builders. Hold your dreams at the lover's hand. It's great. And you put it right up against that clip, the news clip that we played of 500. But 500 is the most in the country, or was at the point that NBC was reporting it there. And, you know, I wish you'd read one more, right back to back with that, because there you've got your grandfather's overalls and your grandma, and we feel that and all the love in it. But then go to the other side of this. Rome wasn't built in a day. It puts a different face on things. I want to talk about the two, if you'd be good enough to read that one. Rome wasn't built in a day. You're talking about young black men as positioned as gladiators in our society.
Yeah. And this is sort of to talk to I don't know if folks who listen to NPR know who Chief Keef is, but he's a rapper from Chicago. And when he sort of blew up or came into the scene, you know, the kind of music he makes is a particular kind of music. And the city especially decided to, you know, the music he makes may sound dangerous or violent. And the city in that moment blamed this 16-year-old kid, you know, for all the violence that was happening in the city of Chicago as if it didn't exist before he was already born. Chicago has emerged a duplication of Rome, a Colosseum for worldwide spectators, eyelashes stapled to eyebrows, corneas wide and waiting on the next Tribune article, on the latest body count, millions of viewers anxious to hear the next bang bang from the pistol mouths of black boys. Hear the applause for more audio. An audience of jackals cackling and cheering on the symphony of corpse pileup in Chicago. Every tongue is mimicking the art of the barrel. Barrels of blood and burials of young through YouTube videos, hip-hop blogs, radio play, glory-chasing boys singing songs of drug trade and gun range of home. They are gladiators fighting on the battlefield where the land mines, police who don't care to protect, news anchors who don't dare report, and schools who only dare to punish. But when the gladiator tells his own story, he blows up. Chief Keef got signed to Interscope with a movie deal. Chi-Raq trended on Twitter. As a joke, 13-year-old rapper Lil Mouse has about 46,000 followers, is on Wayne's mixtape. The dedication we have for this music. Black, death, bullets, and Chicago. We love to dance to it. We love to listen to it. It's so real, so hood, so real, surreal. Black death, bullets, and Chicago. It is happening. It is urgent. More bodies being added to the list of 300. And there is no ignoring this. And we don't. We turn up. This music, louder than a mother's cry for her funeral home children, we glorify. But who benefit from this? No mother, no brother, no sister, no son, no daughter, no aunt, no uncle, no grandma, no granddad, no father, no cousin, no homie, no rapper likes to write eulogies. Who benefit from this? Arena of black boys with spears for hearts, armor skin, and crowds chanting for tombstones. South and West Side don't enjoy building new graveyards while we dance on top. Who benefit from this? Who on top? Who took our love and hip-hop and turned it into love and hip-hop Atlanta? We ratchet, we hood, we laugh like we not wrapped in body bags. Rap about body bags, gold chains and decked out chariots. Who benefit from this? These gladiators don't sleep on skeletons just because they have a bone to pick. Our hoods, cesspools of blood and violence. But who? City planners. Who profit from this coliseum of black boy gladiators celebrated for their carnage, murdering for the world to watch?
Well, Malcolm London reading his poem, Roan Wasn't Built in a Day. What are you charging, Malcolm? What are you saying? I mean, it's pretty clear, but...
Yeah.
But do you have an answer to that? Who?
Well, particularly I do. I think, but folks who actually, you know, profit from this destruction. So one, in the terms of hip hop, right? We look at, particularly there are folks who listen to the music that is produced in Chicago from folks like Chief Keef or whomever, right? And they're, you know, the main consumer of hip hop is white college male students.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a two-tailed piece to these folks who listen to this music, and I hear them say, oh, man, Chicago's so dangerous. And it's sort of this allure that they love to hear about. And then kind of because they're fed, because who controls the media and who controls, you know, or who pays these rappers or who puts them on stages, they hear this and then they kind of develop their own thesis as to how and whom Chicago looks like, and believes this sort of narrative that is on the news, that is in the music, that Chicago is a very dangerous place and that folks are thugs and quote unquote gang bangers. And this idea that folks love to do that. And I can tell you firsthand, nobody loves to constantly live in a state of fear, to constantly worry about having to protect yourself or to kill anybody. No one enjoys that. And, you know, that's sort of what I want to get across, but also that why that exists is a bigger issue. You know, violence, you know, we say Chicago's a dangerous place, and I say, yeah, it is a very dangerous place because you have people who will close 50 schools after an entire city asked them not to haphazardly close 50 schools, and then at the same time regurgitate a new request for charter schools, right? You have a city that is ready to give punitive actions to folks who look like me rather than figure out ways to keep mental health clinics open, figure out ways to not arrest and, you know, basically mess up people's lives for petty nonviolent drug offenses. You know, all of these things contribute to what is in a very quote unquote dangerous city in Chicago.
Make it an arena of black boys you write with spears for hearts. Penela is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Penela. You're on with Malcolm. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Good. Well, this is heavy. I am calling in response to the question you asked about whether or not things could change with a poem, which mm-hmm. is what he's doing. He's expressing himself through poetry, and yes. I think it's just beautiful. And I want to say absolutely. I feel like, well, I know that the beginning to anything that's great will start with words. Words are like a catalyst. And you can't capture the attention of those that have the same heartbeat as yours when you speak. And so that's one of the things that he's doing. He's using his words to communicate not only things that he's dealing with, but what a large area or a large number of people in our society are dealing with day in and day out. And it's not just African Americans. There are Latinos that are dealing with the same situation. There are Caucasians that are dealing with the same situations. I think it's more of a poverty issue, not necessarily an issue of color,
mm-hmm.
because poverty knows no color. And the second thing I wanted to say is that after this catalyst has begun to stir things up, the second thing that and one of the most important things that happens is a movement begins. And so it's not just, you're just sharing your words or you're writing poetry and adding instruments in the background, but you're communicating history, and then you're getting in your community and you're making a difference. And that's something that Malcolm is doing as well. So I want to say kudos to you, Malcolm. And I hope that you will reach so many people that are willing to get in there and get their hands dirty, because they're people that need help. It is a poverty issue. And like I said, it's not, poverty knows no color. And I know that it can seem like that it's African-Americans that are suffering from this injustice, but it's not just black people. It's white people. They're Hispanics. They're people that come here from other nations because they're suffering from the same things in their nations, whether they're of Asian descent or of Indian descent. They come into America because the doors are open and there's room for opportunity.
Penela, you're great. Our time is short before the break, but I so appreciate your call, Penela. You're just terrific.
Thank you, Penela.
Thank you, Penela. Malcolm, if you're a catalyst, what do you want to catalyze?
Well, I first wanted to say thank you to her for the call. But, you know, it's extremely larger than myself, and I want to big up sure. sort of the festival that I help contribute to in Chicago called Louder Than a Bomb, which is a youth poetry festival. And sort of what that did or meant was, you know, in a room in Chicago, bringing together over 120 teams and over 1,000 students in one room to share their voices is much bigger than just write a poem, mm. but or bigger than me, right? There, mm-hmm. there's so many young people, so many people in general who have stories that are valuable, that need to be told, and that also have a narrative. I think when you begin to tell those stories and to have those come out, you begin to see a push and a catalyst change in our culture. And that begins with knowing each other and changing that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with young Chicago poet Malcolm London about mean streets and meaning. Chicago in the news for all kinds of reasons on CNN lately with Robert Redford, executive producer of Chicagoland, 8-part documentary series there. Here's just a little bit from that Finger High School principal, Liz Dozier, interviewed on the difficulties in trying to run a high school in that rough area, her rough area of the city, the South Side, where violence and drugs are a big problem.
Schools become like these dropout factories, and it really has to do with issues that are happening at home that no one's really addressing at the school, because this is really the last stop for 98% of the kids here. Like, if we don't get them off into something else, like, there are no other options.
Malcolm London with his poetry trying to change the frame for himself and many others like him on the South Side, the West Side, all over Chicago. Malcolm, we've got a lot of callers for you, and I want to go to them, but I wish you'd read us one more just before we go there, because we want to hear your voice and your reframing. You've got a poem called Why You Talk Like That.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, I do have that poem. Okay. I'll do that. Why you talk like that? With fake bass in your voice, like you got foundation. Why you talk like that? Speak up. like police lights on street posts, up like that, like surveillance. Can't you see the Cabrini green growing in your esophagus? Talk like you waiting to be gentrified. Why you talk like that? Like coffee, black but not strong, like they like they coffee, integrated, obeying the cream. Talk like a playground in your lungs, where you hide, park, and breathe, and bravado, and belligerence. You native to these West Side Americas. I hear the colonialism in your dialect, where you grew up, where you belong. Loose squares is a mantra. Slurred words like liquor stores on the corners of your cheeks. See your tongue crisp and crossed like your mama didn't raise you on crucifixion. Like you know she pray you never come home in a coffin. Like she know these predators pray more often. Often you speak like you can make institutions disappear like magic, like voodoo in your veins. Like you dream of New Order or New Orleans. Talk like you immune to this Katrina, this hurricane of injustice. Why your slang move like Mississippi then migrated into your saliva? Dixie line diction stirred in kitchens and pots of collard greens, turkey necks, and sweet potato pie. You sweet talk like you met at the intersection of Arsenio Hall and Fresh Prince, that transit authority. That transition to 26th in California is easy for you. You grew up spitting bars. Taste buds grew up on police brutality, dished out in Cook County. You spit like you thirsty, like you been weighed in the water of parasites and low income. Your mouth done dried suppressing all that struggle. The thesaurus in your throat clogs no other word but struggle. In other words, you talk like you never been north, never been freed. Like you have a history you aren't allowed to know. Why you talk like that? Like you got something to say.
Malcolm London's Why You Talk Like That. You're trying to help young people in Chicago, elsewhere, see themselves differently in the world. How important is that?
Well, I think for me, it's extremely important, or at least growing up, is because you often, I think all young people in general, you often have people telling you how you're supposed to be or who you're supposed to be. And I think it's extremely important that you find your own identity and your own voice first and foremost, right? And so it's kind of a catch-22, particularly being from the west side of Chicago and trying to tell students that actually you have no limits to what or who you could be, right? The sky's the limit, as Biggie said. But it's a catch-22, and also saying that that there are limits that exist, and by you living your life as if you have none is sort of a, in a way, continuously breaking those limits to believe that you can do whatever you want. And sometimes the world doesn't tell you that, and sometimes the world tells you you will only be in a prison cell in front of a prosecutor, or you know, you won't make it out of where you're from. So
Barack Obama spent a lot of time in Chicago. President Obama came back there not long ago with his My Brother's Keeper message, also talked about in Washington. And, you know, he said, surrounded by young black men, that when he was their age, he was like them. He sold himself short. He, you know, he got high and didn't think about the consequences and was looking to relate to those young men. Is that helpful? Or is it like, oh, my gosh, the president of the United States, I'm not going to be that. That doesn't relate to me. Or is it helpful?
I think that, you know, I think it's okay to relate to people as the president. I think, though, you know, I would believe, you know, as young people, right, developmentally, we do things and experiment and we do stuff.
Sure.
Right. And so, you know, when we look at, you know, so trying to experiment with weed, right, or marijuana, whatever that is, I think the first problem is that, you know, that it's criminalized to some people, and then to those who, then not to some, right?
What do you mean?
Well, so I mean, I went to Lincoln Park High School, which is great, double honors, all that.
Fancy part of town.
Fancy part of town. And all my friends in school definitely smoked a lot of weed.
These were affluent kids, and many white kids, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. And, however, they had no worry whatsoever about being arrested or being hassled or even, you know, that this idea, you know, that I smoked weed wasn't even a bad thing. And so I have friends, you know, who were from Cabrini Green, which was the project building that was torn down to build a Target. But, you know, they were worried all the time. And half of them despised drugs because they had been taught their entire lives, you know, not to do this, don't do this, don't do this, but were constantly seen as suspects. And so, you know, that's a particular question, that race is still very heavy in how we look and cast and stereotype each other. So as in terms of Barack Obama, I mean, that's cool that he said that. Yeah, I think it's really interesting, though, at a time. I'm very happy that a person who shares the same color as me is in office. But it's very interesting at this time that there are still more black men in prison today as there were in 1865 underneath a black man, which that doesn't necessarily mean that's his fault. But it's very interesting in how we are viewing race or viewing progress in this country. I'll just say that.
Young Chicago poet Malcolm London. Virginia's calling from Bruce Crossing, Michigan. Virginia, thank you for calling. You're on with Malcolm.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, Malcolm, thank you so much. I'm going to start to cry, but I'm going to try not to.
Okay.
Thank you so much. And I was born in Chicago. I'm 70 years old. We moved back there when I was 14. I went to Stony Island High School.
Yeah.
I was one of four white kids in that school. We had a cop on every floor, and my grandson is going to be 29, and he's black and white, and he has two little kids who his woman is Mexican.
Does he live in Chicago, Virginia, or Michigan?
He did live in Chicago. He spent a year up in Upper Peninsula with me.
Yeah.
But now he's been down in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
Texas for about 5 years, because he's got a four-year-old and a brand-new baby.
Congratulations, but how's he doing? How's he see the world, Virginia? We hear your emotion. What's it about?
He's doing terrible. He sees it horrible. He just doesn't see that he has any hope, and I try to talk to him, and he's so angry, and he's done. He put his hands on her, and she called the cops, and they, you know, threw him out, and she should have, because I don't go for that. And I tried talking to him on the phone, and he just blames it all on being black, and it's like one lady said, it's not just black, it's being poor.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry.
That's all right. And that's your grandson. That's your grandson.
Son and my great-grandbaby.
Yeah. Malcolm, I don't know. Do you have comfort for Virginia, Malcolm? Or what do you hear? She's white. Her grandson is, you know, half. Who cares? You hear his despair and the reason he thinks that he is in despair.
Yeah, I mean, so I think definitely in this country and also in the world, poverty is sort of an incarceration in itself. But I would also say that, you know, race, especially particularly in this country, is very, very prevalent in the sense that, which is okay, right? I believe that we're all human beings and deserve a type of quality, or at least opportunity to have quality, the same quality, you know, at me as a young person in Chicago, you know, I would love for my children to go to the same schools that Rahm Emanuel's children go to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis, I think, for all human beings. But we have a particular past and a particular history that deals so heavily with race that we have to, in order to value each other as human beings and to really look at poverty from a lens of human beings and all this other stuff, we have to be comfortable with talking about race as it pertains to us as being human beings. And so talking about your grandson, you know, he may feel that way because, you know, that's a very prevalent thing. I send all my love and support to him because I know how difficult it can be to raise children and to be 29 and to be in Texas is a very hard thing. I think for us as a nation or as in general as human beings is, you know, those children are all that matter, regardless of who you are, from president to your grandson. Right. And as a society, we have to view that in the same ways that, you know, we forget that we were all those children at one point. Yeah. And then we start killing each other or bombing each other or waging wars on each other because of religion or whatever. But we were all those young people, and that's the most important thing, is the next generation. And so, you know, I just send all my love and support to your grandson as much as I can, and that, you know, if anything, I'm fighting to make sure that his children can live in a world where they don't have to go through what he has.
Virginia, you keep heart, and we send strength to you and through you to your grandson and your great grandchild there. Thank you for your call. Adam in Nashville, Tennessee. Adam, you're on with Malcolm London.
Hi, Malcolm. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, what's up, Adam?
I wanted to speak with you, Malcolm, for a second. I'm just a few years older than you, 25. And I'm a blonde-headed, blue-eyed male, white male. And so we all can be labeled as an enemy to somebody based on appearance. But I wanted to encourage you, man. I appreciate what you're doing. And I think that this is truly one of the main things that our country needs to look at. You know, the orphan, the widow, the downtrodden. And I grew up in similar ways that you have. It's kind of funny. I grew up in, when I was a child, I had a stepdad of sorts who was murdered straight out of jail for drug issues. A long list of things like that. But then up to the point now where, you know, I've had runs with the other side of the track, as some say. And it's just, I want to encourage you that, you know, you may look out and you see people who are on your side. You know, regardless of what they look like, I just want to encourage you that there are people fighting for justice all over the country, with all any look, you know. Because as trite as it is, it does come back to you look at somebody and you assume and you can't help it, one thing or another. But just that's all I have to say. Just wanted to encourage
you. Yeah, thank you,
Adam. Thank
you, man. I believe that too, and I see people fighting for justice every single day. One of my favorite things, Cornel West told me, you know, justice is what love looks like in public, right? Mm-hmm. And while I believe that we can, like, we need to, and no matter what color, whatever, we need to always be thinking about, you know, all of our existence is interdependence upon each other, whether we want to, you know, think about it individualistically or not. But, you know, we need to work together, absolutely. But the fight to, you know, end mass incarceration, and the fight to change policy, or the fight to pass a law, you know, while extremely important, and that work needs to happen together to do the real work of repairing what legacies have been left in our country, whether that is because of race, because of sexism, because of gender. You know, that work doesn't necessarily happen because someone is in office or because someone changed a law, right? And that work happens when we acknowledge each other's history, you know, together, and acknowledge these different things. And that happens in community. And in order to build community, we do have to, you know, break down these invisible borders that we have while also fighting for justice in the street and all of that. But we also, you know, have to build community with each other. And that means to me trying to get to an honest space where folks aren't just believe, you know, in this ideal that we're in a post-racial America, or this ideal that, you know, women aren't treated a particular way in this country, or that women of color aren't treated a different way in this country, right? We have to acknowledge those things. I just want to say that too, and that happens in community, and that happens
Cornel West calls you the next Gil Scott Heron, and of course, the guy, the man who wrote The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Those are big shoes. Wow. Are you committed? You're 20 years old. You're so young. Are you committed to this life, the poet life, or maybe we hear a political activist in your shoes? I'm not sure. Art or politics, or both?
Yeah. I think my poems, I think life is political, and you have to think about it that way.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Malcolm London, you're very generous to spend the time with us. Your poetry is just wonderful. We'll put a bunch of it up at the website, and if we can, and we're grateful to you for being with. Good luck to you. Keep saying it.
Thank you, man. Yeah, thank you, Tom. Follow me on Twitter at Malcolm London and Young Chicago Authors at Young Shy Authors. Peace.
We'll do it. Malcolm London in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.